Hello there, everybody. This is Brett Shishkoff. I have Mr. Brian Hawkins next to me, and this is the No Look Pass. Brian, why don't you say hello to all our lovely listeners out there?
Hello, lovely listeners.
Well, on the show, we talk about sports, and I am happy to say that for our Blackhawks section today, we actually have a guest who joined us, and Mr. Judd Surratt from their radio broadcasting team. So I'm looking forward to that. But we will start with other things before we get to the Blackhawks talk. We have baseball talk, actually. It's December, and you ask, why are we talking about baseball? Well, because there were some trades that happened. Why don't you let our listeners know about what has happened in the last day or two with the Sox and Cubs?
Well, I think they are already now.
Probably.
It's a blockbuster trade, sale. And I thought of this yesterday, and so did everybody else. He changed socks, changed the socks.
Uh-huh.
He went from white to red socks. I don't know which is easier to keep clean, but that was the biggest trade. And the only other one that I'm aware of is that the Cubs are looking at getting rid of, or trading, I should say. That's a little more friendlier to say it that way. George Soler, uh-huh, or a pitcher whose name escapes me right now. But the $64,000 question, how do you feel about the Chris Sale trade being a White Sox fan?
Well, I don't like it. I don't really know what to expect from the two prospects that they kind of sent us. They sent us over four players, but there's two of the best prospects that they have, and one of them is supposed to be the best prospect in baseball. But still, you don't know, and there's a lot of these prospects that kind of fall through and don't really work out the way you're hoping. I don't know if that's going to be the case with these guys. So just going to have to wait and see, but I think we talked about this a little bit yesterday about, you know, you always feel more comfortable with what you know, and we know that Sale is good, and he's been good for many years, and it's tough to see him go. He was one of my favorite pitchers. Whenever he was coming on the mound, you felt that it was a good chance that the Sox were going to win that day. Now we have one less pitcher that we feel good about, and the only one that's kind of left that you feel that is going to have a good chance of winning is Quintana, and who knows if he's going to be one that they decide to keep or if they're going to trade him as well. Little uncomfortable with the move that's been made, because now you just are waiting for them to make other moves following the Sale trade. So, I don't know. You said you heard some about Frazier possibly being next.
Well, I didn't like the trade either, actually. The main piece that they traded for, Yon Moncada, he plays third base as well as second base. Now, didn't they bring up a prospect for second base already who they kind of liked? His name escapes me. And so if they want him, Yon, to play third base, then that makes Frazier expendable.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, will he even come up and play this spring?
Right.
I don't know. Is he still going to be in the minor leagues? And if so, what did you do to your team? And then right-handed pitcher Michael Kopech, he is a guy who was injured last year. He throws over 100-mile-per-hour fastball, but there's been some problems with him in the clubhouse. And so, you know, he could be a hothead, and maybe he needs to mature. He's about 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Then they got right-handed pitcher Victor Diaz and Luis Basab, I believe it's his name. And so he's supposed to be a speedster in the outfield. So, yeah, I agree with you. You trade Sale, and it seems like there would be many teams, considering the value of Chris Sale's contract and how much he was to be paid versus his ability, that would have traded for him. And it seems to me you would have gotten a player that you could use right now.
Mm-hmm.
Not this Yon Moncada, who incidentally has played, in other leagues with Jose Uribe.
Huh, okay.
And so, Abreu, I'm sorry, not And so they're familiar with each other, but there's been talk that the White Sox might trade him. And, you know, so I'm not so sure they really are on the right track with this. But we'll see. Big names have been traded before, and many players have come in return, and it's been successful for them. But I think in a lot of those instances, it was players that they could use right away and not just someone that they want to be a prospect. And I looked all over to find out if Moncada is ready to play now, and I didn't see anybody mention it or talk about it or anything.
Yeah, I don't know too much about the guy either. It's going to be an interesting offseason and spring training. I think all eyes will be on these guys that we picked up and seeing if it was worth the trade. They did. The Red Sox did give up a lot to bring him, bring Sale to their pitching staff, which is already a very good pitching staff, and now it ends up being probably one of the best if you think about it. The three that they have, Porcello, who's the second one? Do you remember?
Price.
Oh, Price. That's right. Yeah, they picked him up last year. And then you now have Chris Sale. That's a very, very dangerous three-headed monster pitching staff right there. And the Sox now just have Quintana as that pitcher that is their steady one. So we'll see what happens. It's going to be... I think it's going to be rough. I think we're going to start to see a couple other pieces being traded. I don't think this is the first one to go for the Sox, so it should be an interesting month or two here as we get ready for spring training to start, and that normally starts in the end of February. So,
yeah, well, the only good thing I could say about this, the Red Sox made out, I think, really well. And it might convince David Ortiz to come back and play another year because the Red Sox are now the heavily favored to go to the World Series. The Cubs are number one in terms of the odds, and then the Red Sox are next. And the thing about it is the general manager for the Red Sox now, Dave Dombrowski, he's built two great teams already. I think he had a hand in building the Marlins when they won the World Series, and of course he put together, I think, the Detroit teams when they were contenders every year, and now he's with the Red Sox. So he's had a track record of being an excellent GM. So if he's going to give up a young player for Sale, he pretty much knows, I think, what he's doing. And
from what I understand is he's not very patient. When he sees a team that I believe he thought last year's team should have been in the World Series over that Cleveland team, and they got knocked out, the Red Sox got knocked out early, I think this is him saying he's not done yet. He believes that this team should have made it, and now he put an extra chip to, in his mind, probably solidify their chances of being in a World Series. And hopefully for them, they're hoping they're going to win one. In other news, the Cubs are trying to solidify that spot that Chapman lost with, I don't know if you saw this or not, but Davies from Kansas City, their closer, which is a good replacement. And Epstein's pretty good at like not spending a lot of money on a piece that only comes in maybe a couple times a week and only pitches one inning. He doesn't believe in long time or long contracts for these closers. He did it with Papelbon with the Red Sox, that it was basically year contracts until Papelbon got a 4-year deal with the Phillies, and Epstein was fine with that. And so I think you're going to see that with the Cubs, is that bullpen spot, that end of the bullpen for the Cubs, the closer is going to be someone who's going to be a year-to-year guy. Just Epstein in his history is not willing to pay a long contract for your save guy. What do you think about that move with filling in from Chapman to Davies?
Well, I can argue with it. Soler has been having his problems, his injuries, and the Cubs definitely need pitching. And, you know, you have to have confidence in Epstein. He's done well so far. So, fine with it. It's too bad for Soler, but at least he was on the team to win a World Series, at least, you know, this one year.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the Cubs.
Okay.
Sports Illustrated.
All right.
The Cubs should have been Sportsman of the Year. Instead, it wound up being LeBron James.
The Cubs, just the entire team, should be Sportsman of the Year?
Yes, Sportsmen.
Men of the Year. And
or, yeah, but I mean, it's happened before where you just...
An entire team?
An entire team, you know, as a sportsman. But, you know, LeBron, he's had that honor before, and I, you know, and I don't, and I know he has a close relationship with Sports Illustrated and the people who make that decision.
Right.
But I just wanted to bring that up and say I thought, think that's a bad move.
I agree. I agree with you, too. I agree with you. I think that if he would have won a championship with anyone but Cleveland, I don't think it would have been him. I think it definitely would have been the Cubs, but I think with Cleveland getting their first championship in a long time as well, just that entire city, not just, you know, the Cavs, that I think was the only... That would be the only reason why I would consider LeBron is because it is something that has not happened for that city in a long time, having a championship brought back to them. But yes, the Cubs, it's even longer for the Cubs, that organization. They deserved it more. Just the way that that team is, it's well-liked. There's not really any pieces on the Cubs that you really get frustrated about. Like, I guess maybe Hayward would have been one that you were... felt underperformed, but as an entire team, there's a lot of likable pieces, and you can't help but be happy for this team and what they did this year. And yeah, I agree with you, they deserve to get that that mention or award.
Well, you do make a good point about Cleveland, but if they were going to do that, you know, because of the reason that Cleveland also ended a long drought, then it should have been the Cavaliers as a team, not just LeBron.
This is true. I agree with you on that one.
Yeah.
Can't argue. Anything else in baseball that you've seen that, you know, perked up the eyebrows a little?
No. I think all the big news has been coming from Chicago, and that's it. We've covered it. The only other thing I could say is thinking about this, you know, if you look at the Red Sox, they have this guy, Yon Moncada, and, you know, he's a great phenom and that kind of thing. Great young player, five-tool player. But if you look at the Red Sox, they're set at shortstop. And second base, Dustin Pedroia, you're going to get rid of him. And then you're looking at third base. The third baseman slips my mind right now. But it seems like they didn't really need this guy. So maybe Mr. Dombrowski, you know, I think he made out very well.
Yeah. Yeah, he knew what he was doing, and he knew he had the pieces set to be fine. And like I said, I think he wants to win right away, and this was the piece that he felt was going to be able to put them over the top.
Right.
They still need a DH. If that ends up being Ortiz coming back, then they're fine. But that's a weak link in that offense. But other than that, there's not too many. They're a pretty potent offense.
Yeah, they're the most runs.
Yeah, so.
But Jose Bautista reportedly is available, but I'm just saying.
Yeah, it would be very interesting to see a possible Cubs-Red Sox World Series. You've got two storied franchises, two of, you know, the older franchises in baseball going up against each other. I think it would be another record-breaking World Series for baseball. I'm sure MLB... they're licking their chops at the possibility of seeing a Cubs-Red Sox World Series and the ratings that would come in. And lots of money I would see in this World Series if it ended up happening. But we're only in December, and we haven't even started spring training, and we're already talking about next year's World Series. There's something wrong with us. But I guess that's just what we talk about on the No Look Pass. We talk about what could happen.
Right.
A dream, you know, dreamer's dream. Moving on from baseball, we will move on to, let's go with the Bears.
Got Bears.
They won this past Sunday. It's a surprise because they won. They played San Francisco, so they probably should have won this game, and they did. It was an ugly game. It was during the snow. What did you see during this game there, Brian?
Well, the thing that I'm most curious about is Matt Barkley. Where did this guy come from?
Mm-hmm.
I know he's been in the league for a few years, and that was his first victory. I'm wondering how the Bears feel about him. And reading the newspapers today, they were talking about him being the number two guy next year if he continues to play well. The thing that I've noticed so far is he does deliver the ball accurately.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he had a couple of blips against Tennessee, but you know, a lot of quarterbacks throw interceptions. But he throws the ball accurately and puts it in a position for the receivers to catch. He seems to make good decisions. So I'm just wondering exactly what the Bears feel about him. I think if he plays well against better competition, his stock can only rise. But in the paper they were talking about, he would only still be considered a number two.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to bring back Brian Hoyer. And I kind of think he's a little bit better than Brian Hoyer. But I don't know. Another thing that surprised me, not about the game, but in reading the papers, is that there was an article talking about Fangio could be out the door.
Okay.
And that surprised me because I've been thinking the defense has been the best part of the Bears the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's what kind of caught my eye. And I'm happy to see that. Who was that number 11? Is that Bellamy? Or?
I believe so, yes.
Yes, he kind of redeemed himself. He caught lots of passes after dropping the game-tying touchdown
mm-hmm.
against the Titans. So, well, I don't know. Now, let's see them play a little bit tougher competition if they can stay healthy along the offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kind of things I was looking at.
Yeah, with Matt Barkley, I think it's really tough to kind of determine what he's made out of just because he's never started a football game other than basically the two that he's started so far as a Bear starter. So it's really tough to make a determination of how far he could take the Bears. I don't know if he's a number one. I can't really make that decision based off of the competition that he's played. He has kept them into the in that game against the Titans, and the Titans are an improved team than what they have been, and so they're not a pushover team. San Francisco is one of the worst teams in football, and so yeah, I'm gonna hold and wait before I give him number one status quarterback, just because, like you said, we need to wait and see what else he can do against the tougher teams. I don't know what their schedule, what they have left, if any of those are considered tough competition. I know there's a Lions.
Yeah.
And
Minnesota.
And the Minnesota. So those are some tougher. Well, the Minnesota defense is a tougher one. The Lions have like kind of a middle of a pack defense, but they are the top of the division. So if he can beat the team that's at the top of your division, it's always a good starting point, and it does put a feather in his cap to possibly be in a closer competition with Brian Hoyer next year, or whoever ends up being that other person. But if it ends up being Brian Hoyer, there's no reason why Matt Barkley can't take that job away from him. Brian Hoyer is, I think he's a backup. So I see him more as a number two. So if you just have two number two quarterbacks, that's a little rough, but that's what the Bears have relied on before Cutler was. So you had basically guys who were coming in who really weren't number one championship quarterbacks. They were just guys who you didn't want them to lose the game for you because you had good, stout Bears defenses. So we'll see. I think that you're going to see a team that is trying out for the next year and making a play for John Fox to make his decision of who's he going to keep, who's he going to let go, and where do they need to draft. And so there's definitely a lot of pieces on this team that they need to look at. I think that offensive line still needs a good amount of help, and maybe another pass rusher. And then that, you don't know what's going to happen with Jeffrey. So wide receiver is a position that possibly they need some help with. I think they're okay with the running back position. And I think their linebackers are pretty good. But yeah, those are the places I'm looking at, and you might need some secondary help. So there's definitely some pieces that they need to improve on, and we shall see as the rest of the season goes on. There's only a few weeks left, what this team is made of.
Yeah, they play Detroit this Sunday, so I think we'll find out sooner than later about Barkley. But I expect the Bears to play better these last four games, because they're going to be playing for next season, to be on the team or not to be.
Right.
It should be a good game. It's going to be in Detroit, and Detroit's been hot of late, and it looks like they're on their way to winning the division. So it should be a good game.
Yep. And it's up in Detroit, you said, right?
Right.
Yep. Hopefully we can... because they beat Detroit earlier in the season at home. So it is a team that the Bears have already beaten. So they feel like they have the confidence to be able to do that again, I would think. And I don't know how Detroit is at the top of the division. I don't honestly think that they're that good of a team. But they've been playing teams that... they've been able to squeak out victories. All these games that they've won, they have not, I think most of them have basically been within the last drive. Either Stafford has been able to, get them into the end zone, or it being a game-winning field goal in the last second. So I don't see this team being a championship caliber team, and I think that I think this division was actually more open than the Bears actually realized, that this really could have been their season if they had their heads on straight to begin with, if they were healthy. There's a lot of things with this team that we saw throughout the season that really affected where this team could have gone, and they could have definitely taken this division, because it is a weak division this year. I was expecting Green Bay to bounce back more than they were, and then you had Minnesota, who just really started off so fast and strong, and then they kind of tapered off and had, a four-game losing streak, I think it was.
Yeah.
There's a lot of weak links in this division that the Bears, if it's the same thing next year, Bears could win this division, only having the few wins that they have. They could win the division next year with how weak the division looks like so far.
Mm-hmm.
So...
If things break right and they don't get so many injuries, the key personnel. But I got to say, the thing about Detroit is they do have a pretty good offense. Stafford and Golden Tate, and they have a couple other guys, receivers.
Anquan Boldin, Marvin Jones.
And then it seems that Green Bay has come back from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they'll be able to catch Detroit, because Detroit has a two-game lead on them.
Yep.
But they're still in the hunt. And then Minnesota, the thing about them is that I didn't realize this. I think they said it on one of the broadcasts last week. Norv Turner quit after the team, when they went on that four-game winning streak to start the season.
Yeah.
Soon after that, he quit. And I think it had to do with the fact that they brought in Sam Bradford and they wanted to change the offense. And so maybe that's why they had problems later on. But the division hasn't has been up for grabs, and the Bears did have a chance. If they'd won that Tennessee game, they'd be kind of in the thick of things,
right?
But not to be, but we'll see.
Well, it's interesting, if you look at the division, the Lions offensively have been actually better than what I expected them to be. With losing Calvin Johnson, that offense is pretty good. The defense is lacking. With Minnesota, the offense is lacking and the defense is good. And then with the Packers, the offense has been good and the defense has been lacking. And then the Packers side of it, the defensive side of the ball, they've been missing a lot of key pieces on the defensive side of the ball. Clay Matthews has been in and out. Julius Peppers has been in and out. And then you also have... not Micah Hyde, but Shields, Sam Shields, was the guy who has been missing for them. He kind of is their shutdown cornerback. So a lot of this division has really, I think, struggled with the injury bug. And so it has affected what these teams are capable of doing. You know, Adrian Peterson going down early in the season for Minnesota, I think, was kind of the starting point of that offense not having an identity and not knowing what it wanted to do. And they don't have a number one, it seems. Like, maybe Stephon Diggs can be that at some point, but he's only in his second year, and they're still trying to figure out what they can do with Sam Bradford. He didn't have really an off season with the team. And so he, I think everybody was trying to figure out, okay, Adrian Peterson, he was going to be our bell cow. He's down. Now I have no idea what to do. So a lot of it, you know, when you look at this division, especially with the Bears, they're the ones that you can look at the most of. Injuries have hurt them drastically in what they're capable of doing, and it started off being the defense was relatively banged up, and then throughout the season the offense is pretty much just, they have 3 and 4 wide receivers out there instead of your 1 and 2 guys. And so when you're throwing to guys who can't get separation very well, and you have your third, fourth string quarterbacks, it's just going to be tough. And so it'll be interesting to see if next year that injury bug is gone and what the Bears are capable of doing in this division. Because like I said, it's up in the air, and I think the Bears have as good a chance to win it as anyone else in the division. Anything else in football that you saw this past weekend or the last couple days?
Nothing that comes to mind immediately.
I think the biggest thing that I can think of at the moment is Tom Brady. He broke the record of most wins in NFL history for a quarterback, passing Peyton Manning this past week. That's both playoffs and regular season combined. That's pretty impressive. I forget the number, but it's a lot. His record is, he's way over 500. I know that for sure. But yeah, that's the biggest thing I can think of from this past weekend, of him breaking the all-time record of most wins for a player. Other than that, I think we'll move on. If you don't mind, we'll
sure.
Get right into the Bulls. And the NBA, we have a Bulls team that did really, really well against the Cavaliers, but the last 5 games or so, they're basically have only, I think, won that game, and they've kind of struggled the rest of these games.
Somehow, miraculously, lost to the Mavericks.
Uh-huh.
And then they lost to Portland, and then, of course, last night they lost to Detroit. So that's 3 games in a row they've lost. They went to, after beating the Cavaliers, they went to Dallas, and they didn't have Dwayne Wade back-to-back game. He stayed home.
Yep.
The Bulls went out and played. But to me, it looks like the problem is they're not getting any bench scoring, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that seems to be the number one issue.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think what's impressing me is actually Rondo is playing better than what I expected, and he's scoring more than what I expected him to do. And I think he has to, and I think that's something that he noticed, is that this team needed some extra help. And he's third on the team for three-point average, and he's 33%. And that's not, you know, not great, and it's not terrible either. And so, but yeah, the bench, which we thought was going to be our strong suit, seems to be struggling, and they're not really sure who's the scorer in that second unit. I think with McDermott going down, having that concussion issue, I think that's kind of affected them quite a bit.
That turned out to be huge.
And then Michael Carter-Williams being down as well, I think those two seem to really, in the long term, we're starting to see it affecting the Bulls and the depth that we thought that they had. But I think it's that McDermott injury seems to be the biggest one that has caused that second unit of the Bulls to flounder and just not do the same scoring that we were expecting. Robin Lopez is continuing to be impressive. He's better than what I was expecting. I knew he was going to come in and he was going to be, you know, he was going to be a good fill-in. I didn't expect this, though. He's scoring more than I expected, and he's just being a good contributor. You know, he's doing lots of great screens, and he's contributing not just on the stat sheet, but just working hard.
He knew that he had a hook shot.
Yeah, maybe he was working with his brother over the off season. Who knows? there's lots of good things to see in the Bulls, but yes, this bench needs to wake up and snap out of whatever funk they're in, and otherwise, this Bulls team is going to struggle. And now I think they're only one game over 500. They're 11-10 at the moment. They lost last night against Detroit. Which is a tough team. They're one of the better defensive teams in the league. They're only giving up, I think it was, they said last night, 96 points. There's on defense, second in the league. So it was a tough team, but it's still a team that they should have won against. They had all their starters going for the Bulls, but they weren't able to pull it out in the end. I think in the beginning of the quarter, they were only down by one, and by the end of the game, it was closer to 10 that they lost by.
Right. And when they played the Mavericks, they came out sluggish, and they, you know, I think lots of minutes went by before they even scored their first basket.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems that when certain players come off the bench, they don't contribute as much as they need to.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the scoring for last night's game, and Cannon came off. He only scored 2 points. I think Mirotić scored five or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In single digits. And they can't have that. And Portis didn't even play. And, of course, you know, he has had his issues.
Yep.
And they decided to go with Christo, I think, or I guess I should get his name down at some point. But and he scored, I think, 6 points. But that's the main thing, is their bench is just not contributing. And I think McDermott might be back Thursday night.
Okay. Hopefully. Well, that would be a good hopefully he's not too rusty. I'm sure he'll be on he might be on a minutes restriction, but we'll see.
Yeah, well, they sent him to the D-League to get some
reps in.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Some reps in. So, and Michael Carter-Williams will probably be around the corner. So hopefully they can help. Certainly the three-point shooting is necessary, but I look for Mirotić to break out pretty soon. He's maybe the past 2-3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
He hasn't been playing well.
Yeah.
So not scoring, at least. He's been contributing, rebounding a little bit here and things of that nature, but nowhere near what you would expect considering his range with the three.
Yeah, hopefully we'll see that happening. All he needs to do is continue shooting. Shooting guards have a tendency, or shooters just have a tendency to go through these funks sometimes. Some players have them longer than others, and hopefully this is just a rough patch, and hopefully he can turn it around. One thing I did want to touch on, I don't know if you have anything else for the Bulls, but one thing I wanted to touch on for NBA specifically was, in two nights in a row we've saw two players go over 50 points and contribute in a lot of different facets. Last night we had 50 points from John Wall, and then the night before we had 60 points from Klay Thompson. And you have a record that Michael Jordan has had for triple doubles, with Russell Westbrook actually having the chance to get his seventh tonight. With all of these players scoring so many points and contributing on the offensive side of the ball, do you think that this is just where the athletes are so much better than what they used to be, or is it more of where the game has gone that it's more conducive to having these players being able to score, since it's not such a defensive-minded NBA? What do you feel like about this? Like, you're seeing these scores happening where 50-point games used to be a rarity, and now they are becoming more the norm that you see these 40-point games. What do you think about that, the way that the NBA has changed, or do you think it's just, you know, an anomaly that's happening currently?
No, that's what the NBA has wanted. They've always wanted more scoring. And then the emphasis on the three-point shot, that, you know, you're going to expect it. Klay Thompson hit 60 points the other day, I believe.
Yep.
And I don't know how many threes he had, but I'm sure quite a few. But no, you know, I think it's legitimate. That's what they want. They want, and as a matter of fact, I think the players should be better scorers. That's something that I've always been a pet peeve of mine, is that some of the players in the league just don't have any offensive skills,
yep.
particularly some of the bigs. And I think that's why the three-point has become such an emphasis. There are guys, and I'm not picking on him necessarily. I like him as a player, but I've just happened to watch him recently. That's why he comes to mind, and that's Tyson Chandler. He used to play for the Bulls. Now, mm-hmm. he's a great athlete and a great rebounder offensively, defensively, but he doesn't have any offensive moves. And, like, for instance, I just happened to be watching the DePaul-UCLA college game from 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of their big players who played that game, like Mark Aguirre and Teddy Grubbs, when they would get the ball down low on the block, they would take a drop step and immediately turn and shoot the ball. And then they would shoot it behind their head. And, you know, they had offensive moves on the block. And a lot of bigs don't have that now. You know, that's why Joel Embiid of Philadelphia is such a standout, because he does have offensive moves like that. So, no, but, you know, I think that's why you're seeing players score such huge points, is because offense has been preferred in the NBA, because they want these, you know, NBA type scoring, 115 points, 120 points. I think those are the type of games, because they used to frown upon the defensive struggles in the 90s, where you'd have an NBA finals where, like, the Bulls would score 95 points and the Knicks would score 89,
you mm-hmm.
know, and they're like, no, like, we don't want that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it's fine. The players should work on their skills so that they can be better scorers. I just wish some of the bigs would do that.
Yeah, I personally am a person where I like the grinded out games. I like seeing those games of good defense. I've just liked the physical aspect of just, in all my sports, I like physical defenses. In football, it's the same thing. And so seeing where it's at, I feel like it's going to be a detriment to the sport, because one of the things that frustrate us is when we watch the Pro Bowl and we watch the All-Star Game for basketball, is there's no defense, and these are not very high-rated games. They're not watched as much as what they would hope. And so now you're getting into the other night, that score for the Golden State Warriors, it was like 135 to 120 or 140 to 130. I forget exactly what the end score was, but you're already getting up to all-star level scores, where when you don't have any type of, like, it's just that Ole defense. It's just them doing a three-point contest or a slam dunk contest. I think people lose interest because there isn't that competition on both sides of the ball. Like, when you need a stop, that you're going to get a stop, or that there's a possibility you get a stop. Now it's just, it runs up and down the court, and it's fun to watch to a certain extent, but I think it will get old, and I think people will just be get frustrated like they are with football. Of it, just the sports are changing, and I think a lot of people do like those physical aspects of these sports, and all these sports are trying to encourage getting away from that style of game, and that's a little frustrating to me.
Yeah, I see your point. I like to watch defense as well.
Mm-hmm.
But a team like Golden State, I mean, you know, you really can't, the way that Curry and Thompson shoot the three, you really can't defend them, because, you know, Curry will stop and pop, as they say,
yep.
and he'll hit the three with consistency. So, but yeah, I didn't see the 50-point game or the 60-point Klay Thompson performance, so I don't know if, you know, how well they were being defended.
Yeah.
But I definitely want defense, but I think that, you know, it's not such a bad thing that the scoring is going up. I would prefer that it's a result of the players being better shooters as opposed to not any defense being played.
Yeah.
That's how I would like to see it being done.
Yeah, I just think it's amazing to see all of these players being able to get to 40 points like it's nothing. Like, that's something that is interesting to me to see, because like I said, it was just such a rarity that you'd see a 40-point game in the era of Michael Jordan, that like when that would happen, it was a big deal. And now you have these 60-point games and 50-point games that you see more frequently. And then with Russell Westbrook every night, James Harden every night, triple doubles all over the place. You don't see that from a point guard very often.
Yeah, okay, but those two players, when they play, not only what happens with them is they are taking the ball to the basket and they get fouled.
Yeah.
So that's why they're getting a lot of points. You know, they're scoring, they're hitting their layups, especially James Harden.
He'll hit
the layup and then he'll get fouled. They live on the free throw line.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I can understand. In that instance, it's understandable because they're trying to play defense. It's just bad defense and they're hacking this guy. And he's so strong that it's hard to stop him when he – and Russell, you don't want to get in front of him when he's got a head of steam.
Yeah, he's very quick and, strong dude.
But the thing of it is, and I think another thing is happening, is that these guys are the only ones scoring.
Yeah.
So teams are depending upon them. Because I think if you look at the scoring line last night for the Bulls, there were two players that were in double figures. It was Wade, and then there was Jimmy Butler. And Jimmy Butler had like 30 points or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And Wade had what he had, maybe 20. But everybody else, 6 points, 5 points. I think our guy in the middle had 11 points. You know, so if you have a guy and he's, you know, and 60% of the offense is going through him, then he's going to be putting up numbers like that.
Yeah, but when you look at it that way, if that's the case of like, guys getting to the line, that's also a bit of the game changing, and it slows down the pace. And so you even see teams who do have these big guys like Drummond, you know, DeAndre Jordan, Cousins, you do see the hack a shack, or you know, that's what they call it, and just putting these guys to the line, and they're going to the line 20 times a game and they're making 5 or 6. And that's, you know, that's just, as a coach, it's probably good game planning, because then you know that guy, maybe he's hitting one and they're only getting 1 point each time they go down. And I understand that part of it, but it also takes away from the aspect of letting them play and being able to let certain plays just happen. Like, it's basketball. When you're going for a rebound and you're going up for a layup, you're going to bump each other. Like, there are blatant fouls that you can tell when it's blatant, but then there's times where, like, James Harden and Russell Westbrook, you can tell that they go up and they barely get touched, and it looks like they're about ready, that they literally got tackled. And so those are things that you start to look at, of just, like, these players know that it's such a ticky-tack type of league now that they get these calls and they barely are touched. And that's also something that you didn't see as much. Like, you would only see it with the best players of the game. Like, Jordan wouldn't, every now and then he would get that call. But most of the time when he was getting fouled, he was getting literally destroyed by people. And now it's, you breathe on them the wrong way and it's a foul. And these players know it and they act that way. And James Harden is one of the biggest contributors to that. Like, so many of the games that I listen to, they actually say somebody's pinky like grazed his arm, and it ended up that it ends up being a foul and he falls on the ground. And it's like, you didn't get touched. Like, how are you falling on the ground and you barely were grazed? And so those are frustrating parts of the game that you kind of see, like, yeah, they're getting to the free throw line and that is contributing to their score getting up, but it also is slowing down the pace of the game. Is that really what the NBA wants? Is literally to see, you know, 40 free throws being shot a game, 53 throws being shot a game, because that's what they're getting up to. They're between 30 and 45 free throws a game, and that slows down the pace. That's not, they want more scoring, but in the way that the NBA is and the calls that they're making, it actually is slowing down the game more so than anything. And they have replays as well that slows down the game. So some of the things that the NBA is asking for is the same frustrations that I have with the NFL, of they want more scoring and they want it to be a higher paced game, but they just keep adding more rules and replay, and that doesn't speed up the process any. So it's counterintuitive to me. And so, I don't know, there's just a few things that I've been noticing, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on that and see what you were thinking about the NBA and how it compared to the frustration that people have with the NFL. Do you think that that could be, you know, the same thing with the NBA eventually?
Well, yeah, I think it has been in the past where people have grown tired, and I think that's why the NBA made changes. They wanted they wanted to put the emphasis on the three-point shot. And to your point, the Bulls, they shot, 33 free throws, or attempted 33 free throws.
Yep.
And the last night, or 32, and Detroit 21. So, yeah, it's a lot of game stoppage. But here's a stat for you. Chicago from the three-point line, 2-15.
Ouch. That's not good. Yeah, that's very bad.
And, yeah, and so you got, it seems that you have a situation where if you have one guy doing most of the scoring, then you're going to have those huge, you know, performances. They're going to the line. They're hitting their shots. And other players are looking for them. Because in the NBA, there is this adage that if a guy gets hot, you know, you keep feeding him the ball until he cools off.
So. Yep. And that's what the Golden State did the other night. Is they basically, there were times I was hearing them like explain the highlights where both Kevin Durant and Steph Curry, they actually put their hands behind their head to like when they would give the ball over to Klay, and they would pass the ball to him and they'd put their hands behind their head and just walk away, because it was like they even said that he would throw up a shot and it would, no person should make this shot, and it was just going in. There's just certain nights that it happens that way, and it was Klay's night that happened. And so, yeah, you're going to feed the guy who has the hot hand, and that's what they did. And that's fine. I like seeing these games from time to time, but when they start to become the norm, then it's not as impressive, and 60 points is still rare.
Yeah.
Moving on, we actually have the Judd Surratt interview coming up for the Blackhawks. I don't know if you wanted to add anything for the Blackhawks. If not, we can just go to that.
Okay.
Well, we're moving on to the Blackhawks here, and we actually have a special guest with us today. Judd Surratt from the Blackhawks has come to join us. Why don't you say hello there, Judd?
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Well, since you're here to talk about the Blackhawks, we'll just get right into it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been with the Blackhawks?
Well, Joel Quenneville and I basically started around the same year. So this is my ninth season with the Blackhawks, being a part of the radio team with John Weideman and Troy Murray, both great guys to work with. In conjunction with that, I used to do the Cubs along with the Blackhawks for about six seasons. And then prior to that, I spent some time doing the NHL nationally on HDNet, which is a network run by Mark Cuban. And I'm fortunate. I've spent more than 20 years in the pro game. I was also with the Chicago Wolves for 12 seasons, which was absolutely fabulous. But I am very fortunate. The Blackhawks were my favorite team growing up. Dennis Savard was without question my favorite player. I was certainly inspired the first time I saw Savvy play, and I heard Pat Foley do a game, and I figured this is what I wanted to do. And years later, I am very fortunate that I've been able to do this with my favorite team in my hometown.
Yeah, it's really awesome. I was listening to your guys' broadcast last night, and we had a nice little victory yesterday. I think the end score ended up being 4-0, right? Or did we score one?
It was. It was a much-needed victory, because really here in the last couple of games, they haven't played the same way. Obviously, they're missing a couple of key players in Jonathan Toews and Corey Crawford, and then Brent Seabrook had to leave last night's game and didn't finish, so we'll have more news on Brent's status probably tomorrow, because the team is not practicing today. But listen, the Blackhawks have gotten off to a great start, maybe even better than they anticipated, because remember, you're icing a lot of rookies. At one point, you could have six first-year players and five rookies in the lineup. But really, the theme of the season for the Blackhawks, the goaltending has been exceptional. They have found ways to win. And at key points, your star players, like Marian Hossa did the other night, scored two goals. they have been able to capitalize with key tallies at key times, and that's allowed the Blackhawks to vault to the top of the Western Conference standings 28 games into the season.
Yeah, which is always nice to see our guys right at the top. I know for myself, I was expecting us to have a little bit of some struggles beginning of the season with having some young guys coming in and new players coming in and having to feel each other out. I know that the off season is relatively short for the Blackhawks. This one has been a little bit of a longer one because of them not going into a deep playoff run. So maybe they were a little bit more rested this season coming around, and they just wanted to get back at it. And hopefully we'll see another Stanley Cup come to Chicago, since we have now a World Series champion with the Cubs. Maybe we'll see the Blackhawks want to be back on top again.
Maybe. They've got a chance. You know, when you talk about the long offseason, I think the guy who had really benefited most was Marian Hossa. You can make an argument that Marian has probably played more high-intensity hockey, more Stanley Cup playoff games than any player around the league. Because remember, 2 years prior to joining the Blackhawks in 2009-10, he went to the Stanley Cup Finals with the Red Wings and the Pittsburgh Penguins. So he needed some time off. And I think that you're seeing that extra time paying some dividends here early in the season. He's got 14 goals in the first 28 games for the Blackhawks. That's a 40-goal pace. I don't know if he's necessarily going to keep that up, but he has never had a 40-goal season since he's come over to the Blackhawks. He has done it three times during his career. And I do think that you did see some of the pitfalls that you were worried about with the team trying to work in as many first-year players. And also you've got some different bodies that you didn't have last year, guys like Brian Campbell playing on the back end, Michael Kempney also playing on the back end. But a lot of that was covered up by some of the things that we already were trying to talk about, that the goaltending has been able to keep you in games, and the key players have found ways when the game is on the line to score big goals or make big plays to allow you to win some games. It hasn't always been smooth, but they've been able to pick up points. The conference and really the entire National Hockey League is so close, so every point is vital. They've gotten off to a good start and put themselves in a good position.
Yeah, I think when you look at this team, you're seeing contributions from multiple lines, which last year they seemed to struggle a little bit. You had the Panarin and Kane line, which did really, really well last year, and it seemed like the rest of the lines had long instances of struggling. And this year it seems, at least to start off with, that there isn't that same struggle across the lines. You see the first line doing a little bit more with Toews and Hossa, his scoring coming back, and then you have the young kids, they're contributing relatively quickly. So when they're not able, the defenses aren't able to just pinpoint on one specific line, I think it makes it really, really difficult on the other teams, and line changes for the coaches on the other side. Coach Q seems to be doing a pretty decent job with the lines. I know on that road trip he tried bringing Kane and Toews together, which is something that he normally doesn't do, and now I think they kind of have fallen back to what the normal lines have been. Do you see that change being good, putting Kane and Panarin back on the same line again?
Well, I think you got a number of different things. First of all, Joel's goal, and if you look back when the team won in 2009-2010, you had a four-line rotation. That's always been a theme for the team when they've been at their best. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Blackhawks haven't necessarily, and I'll use Joel's term, nailed it when it comes to having that four-line rotation. You did mention some of the changes that Joel made. Jonathan Toews got off to a slow start. He put Kane and Toews together. Jonathan's game started to develop a little bit. Then he and Kane got a little stale together, and then Joel moved Kane back with Panarin and Anisimov. We'll see what happens when Jonathan Toews works his way back into the lineup, and we're not exactly sure when that's going to be. Joel did mention yesterday that Toews would be on the trip when the Blackhawks head to New York next week to meet the Rangers and the Islanders, so that's a good sign. But who he's going to be playing with, what the combinations are going to look like, not exactly sure. But you mentioned some of the contributions that you've gotten. Ryan Hartman's gotten off to a good start. Tyler Mott, before he got injured, was chipping in some key goals. Marian Hossa has been terrific. Kane, Panarin, and Anisimov back together again. Mm-hmm. Obviously, those guys are, as a threesome, maybe the most dangerous combination or one of the most dangerous combinations in the National Hockey League. And I'm sure Jonathan's game will start to pick up. He is a notoriously slow starter. The other thing that Joel has wanted offensively from this team is to get the defense more involved. Heading into last night's game, as a group, the Blackhawks defensemen had only 8 goals. They picked up a ton of points, but there's a lot more offense there, and hopefully we'll start to see that in the last two-thirds of the season.
Yeah, I know Brent Seabrook is normally one who contributes pretty well on the defensive side, and Keith, he will get in his occasional goals as well. Do you think that you'll see some more scoring from the other defensemen as well? And how can they improve that side of things? I know the penalty kill also has been a little bit of a struggle. Where do you think that these Blackhawks still have some improvement? And do you think they can make those improvements? Or do they need to maybe make a move before the trade deadline to make that final push and run for another Stanley Cup?
Okay, well, there's a couple of things there. I guess I'll start with the last thing.
Sure.
Right now, the Blackhawks are pressed up against the NHL salary cap, so if they're going to make a move, there's going to have to be money that goes out of the team, so you're going to have to trade some money in order to bring somebody back at this point. As far as the defensemen, with Duncan Keith and Brent Seabrook, listen, these guys are two elite defensemen, and two guys who picked up a number of points throughout their career. I think for the Blackhawks, for all of those defensemen, they need to get more involved in the attack. We saw that right off the hop last night in the game against Arizona, where Patrick Kane was looking to the middle of the ice, and Brent Seabrook was close. You hear gap being talked about a lot of times, and that's basically the space between the forwards and the defensemen. He moved up so Patrick Kane could make a short 10-foot pass to a guy like Seabrook, who's a very dangerous and, I think, underrated offensive player, could get off a shot. So I would imagine that I think that you'll see these guys start to collect more goals. Brent Seabrook had a fabulous offensive season last year, especially on the power play. He's got a wicked blast from the right point. But I would imagine that he and Keith have some goals in the bank, and you're going to see some get deposited here into the net in the next two-thirds of the season. Beyond that, you talked about the penalty kill, and that's been sort of a work in progress. You know, you can't take out what happened to the team in the first 10 games and their deficiencies there. But they have slowly started to improve. It starts with your goaltender. He has to be your best penalty killer. And then beyond that, it's the ability of those four-man units to work in tandem. It's got to be about work ethic. You've got to outwork that power play that you're up against. You've got to get in lanes. You've got to block shots. And when there are second opportunities, you have to be in good position defensively to either clear the man, take the man, or get that puck out. We're seeing the Blackhawks do a better job of it. Obviously, it still has a ways to go, but you have a lot of experienced guys back there, and you have a lot of guys who you can utilize as penalty killers. So I have no doubt that the Blackhawks will trend in the right direction when it comes to PK.
Well, I think that is a lot of great information, and the only other question I have for you is, do you think this team has enough? Do you think that they could possibly bring us back another Stanley Cup?
I do. I do, and I think you have to look at the core first and foremost. You've got Corey Crawford, who's already won it twice. You've got an outstanding group on the back end that's at least 6, maybe 8 deep at this point. And then obviously you have 2 world-class players up front in Kane and Taves, plus you had Panarin, Anisimov, Marian Hossa. So you have the depth, you have the experience. And now maybe because you had that long offseason, you have a team that's refreshed and ready to go once the playoffs hit, because it is a difficult journey once the Stanley Cup playoffs begin to not only make it out of your division, make it out of the Western Conference, but see if you can beat somebody from the East to raise your 4th Stanley Cup here in less than a decade.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, and I definitely hope it does happen. I do have to say, I do listen to your broadcasts quite often. I myself lost my sight over a couple years ago, and so now watching hockey is not something I do very often. I do still tune in to listen to Foley and the TV broadcasting team, and so it ends up that I kind of switch back and forth because I like both the telecast and the radio broadcast. I enjoy the input that you guys end up putting in. And thank you very much for all the work you guys put in every year. I don't know how many people get a chance to thank you, but I enjoy the broadcast that you guys put on.
Well, it's the other way around. It's me who should be thanking you. And I worked for years with Pat Hughes, and Pat and I used to talk about when you would get letters from people whose sight was impaired, mm-hmm. or they no longer had it, that those in many ways were some of the most important letters. And hearing what you had to say about our broadcast is high praise, because we are there to try and paint those pictures for you and try and help you out so you can envision that. And if we're able to do that for you, then we're doing our job, you know, and it's the highest praise to be able to create that vision for people who don't have that ability or have that ability impaired. And it's something that I think as broadcasters, especially on radio, we should always strive for. So thank you.
Yes, I enjoy it, and I definitely look forward to hearing more broadcasts throughout the season, and hopefully I'll hear at the end of the season you telling us that we have another Blackhawk Stanley Cup, and maybe we can have you on again.
Looks like we're going to have to talk in late June.
All right, I look forward to it. You have a good one, Judd. Thanks again for joining us.
You got it.
Well, it's been a great show. Brian, thanks for joining me, and I also want to thank Judd Surratt for joining us also for the show and contributing for the Blackhawks conversation with me. Brian, why don't you give us a final thought to leave us with?
Wow. Right off the top of my head. Well, I was thinking in terms of the Bulls.
Okay.
They're giving days off to Dwayne Wade. Shouldn't they do the same thing with Jimmy Butler? I mean, they're putting a lot of pressure on him. He's playing a lot of minutes, scoring. He scored 32 points last night. And you kind of think they're trying to save Dwayne Wade, but wouldn't it be unfortunate if towards the end of the season Butler starts to break down and they still have to rest Wade? If you're going to do it, you should make a plan so that everybody, or at least, you know, he gets some rest. I don't know. That's just something that popped in my head.
I think we'll visit that a little bit further, but just to answer that shortly, I agree with you. I think they will, as the season goes on, later in the season, you might start to see some days off for Jimmy, but he is still relatively young, and I think Jimmy likes to play every day. I think it's just something that he probably, if he needs a day off, I would hope that he would tell them that he needs a day off, but right now I think he just wants to play. He feels like he's one of the best players in the league, and he wants to show that every night. That's kind of my thoughts on that. Is it's more of a Jimmy Butler, and I think Dwayne Wade is asking for these days off just to conserve himself for a hopefully long playoff run.
Right.
All right. Thank you for joining us today on the No Look Pass. I am Brett Shishkoff once again, and this is Brian Hawkins. We will talk to you all next week.